Okay, today we are going to talk, or really watch, a video debate on is God necessary for morality? But some preliminary introductory things. The handout is a summary of Shelley Kagan's presentation. And so the reason I'm giving you this, so William Lane Craig is arguing the Christian position that God is necessary for morality. Shelley Kagan is arguing the position that God is not necessary for morality. And Kagan is a really good teacher and speaker. He is a ethicist. He teaches, I think, at Yale, essentially teaching moral philosophy and arguing these things. But he's a little bit of a conversationalist while he talks, so it's hard to structure his argument if you're not paying attention. So I gave you this to try and help you structure his argument. And also, if you get lost on the point that he's making or the argument he's making, I gave you timestamps throughout. So I'm going to have the this up here in the corner, and this little number up here is going to tell you.
The key word in that.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I can't make it any bigger.
But I can see it fine, Denise.
Well, you're not 46, or is that 64?
Wait, when was your birthday?
Ooh.
But that ideally that'll help you follow his argument, so you can see where are we up there and jump to where that is in the argument. Gonna give you a summary of his argument before you even hear it, though, and that's the first few pages. So, the question of is God necessary for morality? It's can morality exist without God first existing to bring it into being, to have it be an objective thing? So that's the question.
No.
Kagan says, first of all, he tells you what he thinks the basic moral law is, which is don't hurt, do help. He'll explain that. He says that's what the moral law is, and then he says, since I didn't refer to God in that, it seems to me perfectly reasonable to say that God's not necessary for us to discern what the moral law is. Don't hurt, do help. So this moral law is objective and can't exist without God is his next argument that he tries to. And he says if we need to find a deeper source to account for its existence, he essentially appeals to reason itself. He gives this idea he calls it the contractarian idea, the idea of a hypothetical bargaining situation where if everyone were perfectly reasonable agents, we were to sit down and decide what are the moral rules. Purely logically speaking, what were the rules we'd come up with? They could be boiled down to don't hurt, do help. He'll explain all this. I'm just trying to give you a precursor so it's not as much of a surprise when you hear it the first, so you can follow the argument better.
So Shelley is a guy?
Yes,
okay,
yes.
Okay, I was confused with you.
Yeah, Shelley Kagan is a man.
Got it.
Other question?
Is he a Christian?
He's not. He's an atheist.
Is anyone a Christian? Craig?
William Lane Craig is a Christian. He's an Armenian Christian, but he's a Christian.
Is that where he loses, right?
Yeah, this is the one, this is the only, and I mean, technically, I think he actually technically won, but when I first watched this debate, I watched that and go, Shelley Kagan destroyed William Lane Craig. He only won because he was in a Christian context. The Veritas Forum is the one setting it up, so pretty much whoever sets up the debate has the winner picked out before they even start the debate, honestly. Yeah. William Lane Craig is one of the leading apologists, synthetic apologists, I should say. He debates all of the big atheists on these kind of issues. Is God necessary for morality? Does God the existence of God? All of these apologetic ideas, he's one of the leading guys. And I would say this is the only debate I've ever watched of his where I walked away going, I think he lost that debate. I think Kagan did a better job in the argumentation. We're going to watch, to start with, we're just going to watch Kagan's opening introduction statement. So the way the debate was organized was each one got 20 minutes to give their spiel, their argument, and then there was back and forth for, I think, 40 minutes. So we're going to watch Kagan's opening presentation on how he would suggest you can do this without morality, without God. And then we're going to talk about it, and then we'll decide which sections of the rest do we want to watch, because we can't watch all of it. It's too long. You'll probably want to watch all of it, I think, once you see a little bit of it. And you just Google Shelley Kagan, William Lane Craig, morality. It'll be on YouTube. It's the first one that comes up. So you can watch the whole thing there. So that's the intro. Everybody kind of clear on what we're doing. So for starters, we're just going to watch his opening statements for 20 minutes, and then we're going to pause it and discuss his arguments. And I'm also going to, hopefully, I want you to listen real carefully and see if you can spot the fallacy, because there's a very sneaky fallacy that he sneaks in that Craig doesn't catch, and I actually think that's why he loses the debate, because he just, it seems so solid when Shelley Kagan presents it, and but there's a really sneaky little fallacy. So without further ado.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I want to thank the Veritas Forum for inviting me, and I want to thank Bill Craig for agreeing to this discussion, this debate. The topic for tonight's debate is whether God is necessary for morality. Is God necessary for morality? I'm going to be arguing that a belief in God or the existence of God is not necessary for morality. I'm in a bit of a handicap in doing this. I spoke to one of my colleagues, another moral philosopher, gave him the topic, is God necessary for morality? And his answer was, well, of course not. Now, I don't think the issue is quite as open and shut and black and white as that, but it does suggest, it does reveal, I suppose, a common outlook among moral philosophers that I share, that people have been doing moral philosophy without appeal to God for thousands of years, at the same time that they've also been doing moral philosophy that does appeal to God. It's not at all obvious to those of us who take a secular approach to doing moral philosophy what the problem is supposed to be. So I'm going to try to anticipate what some of the difficulties that Bill Craig will be raising, and maybe that's unfair. I don't mean to be saddling him with objections that he doesn't raise, or of course maybe I will be raising objections that he will go on to raise and he'll do a better job of it. So I may not get it quite right, but what I'll try to do is sketch a little bit about where I think a plausible account of morality might be that doesn't make use of the appeal to God, and try to answer some objections that one might raise against it. Second preliminary remark is I'll no doubt typically talk about what the atheist might say or the atheist might believe or an atheist approach to moral philosophy, and that's a bit of a misnomer because I'm describing a view that's completely available to theists as well. And calling it an atheist view, I simply mean it's a view that does not make use of the appeal to God. It's not theistic, it is atheistic in that sense. And it's not necessarily limited to those who deny the existence of God. Let me start by putting aside a question that may be of interest to some of you, and if it does come up in the question period, I'm happy to address it at greater length. But one thing one might worry about in asking whether or not morality requires the existence of God is whether people could act morally if there is no God, or if they didn't believe in God, whether moral motivation or moral behavior presupposes in some way belief in a deity. I certainly hope that it's apparent to every person in this audience that the answer to that question is certainly not. That is to say, atheists, and here I do mean atheists in the more narrow sense, people who deny the existence of God, are just as capable of acting morally as anybody else. They're just as capable of acting immorally as anybody else. Theists, at any rate, don't have any kind of monopoly on moral behavior. And I'm completely confident that Bill will agree about that. It's, I think, such a non-issue that, as I say, I'm going to say nothing more about it. The more interesting question, there are several questions one might pursue, but the one I'll be focusing on, what I take to be perhaps the most interesting question, is whether or not we need God for there to be morality, for there to be a genuine difference between right and wrong. Here we think of God not as the motivator for moral behavior, but rather God as the source or the author or the ground of morality, its basis. And so the question I'll be focusing on is whether or not there can be a secular, non-theistic basis for morality, and I believe the answer to that is yes. Now, I could get off at this point, except, of course, again, I don't think there's going to be any difference of opinion between Bill and me on the question, do non-theists believe in morality? Of course we all believe in morality. It's whether or not there could really be something. Am I, as an atheist, entitled to talk about right and wrong as something that genuinely exists without having God? So that's the question I'm going to focus on, not whether, you know, people talk this way, whether the atheists talk this way, whether there's some logical difficulty about their talking that way. So what I'm going to do is very quickly sketch an outline of a view about ethics that I find congenial. It's not at all original to me. I don't in any way mean to suggest it's the only kind of outline one could accept as an atheist trying to explain what morality is all about, but it'll give you an illustration of, I think, a fairly plausible approach, or so it seems to me. And then I'll raise some deeper questions about it. So here's the basic idea. Right and wrong is a matter of whether or not your behavior hurts people or fails to help them. So, which is wrong action is action that hurts somebody or fails to help them in the relevant circumstances. And right action is basically a matter of those behaviors that refrain from hurting people and do provide help. So once we've got this basic idea in place, it's pretty natural to see how the more familiar rules of ordinary common sense morality fall out from that. We have an explanation as to why it is that you shouldn't lie, because lying hurts people, why you shouldn't commit murder, why you shouldn't rape, because rape hurts the victims of rape, why you have to aid the needy, why slavery is wrong, why you need to clothe the naked and feed the hungry. In all these ways, these behaviors are morally wrong or right because of their connection with harm and failure to help. Now, there's a lot of details that would need to get worked out. I think for tonight's purposes, they're not likely to be all that important. Let me just mention that, of course, it's important to get clear that there's a variety of ways that people can be hurt. There's not just physical harm, but there's emotional harm, and there's assaults on somebody's autonomy, and you can fail to respect them in a variety of ways. I don't think I need to pursue that, so unless it comes up, I won't say more about that. And the second point is that, of course, to say that you can't ever harm is a bit of a simplification. There are going to be cases in which one would have an adequate justification for harming somebody else. For example, in cases of self-defense against a deliberate aggressor. There's a great deal of work in contemporary moral philosophy about what these exception cases are, what are the adequate justifications for harming or failing to help. And again, although I'm happy to go there, I don't think we need to, so I won't say more about it unless it comes up. Now, that's the nutshell of the moral theory that I believe in. Clearly, I didn't say anything about God, and so it seems to me I'm entitled to say that I believe in morality, I'm entitled to believe in morality, and the question I only want to ask at this point is, why would anybody think otherwise? Well, so here's a worry that one might have. We might ask, not do I believe in this sort of thing, but are these things really wrong on the atheist view that I've just sketched? Or is it just a matter of opinion? Now, that's tricky. Of course, we're going to be arguing about whether or not God's necessary for morality, what shape morality has, and so forth and so on. And all that, in some sense, is just a matter of opinion. But I take it the deeper question is there a fact of the matter as to who's right? Now, just as there's a fact of the matter as to whether or not there is a God and what that God is like, I take it there's a fact of the matter with regard to whether or not it's wrong to harm people, whether it's wrong to rape, for example. I think it's wrong to rape. I take this to not just be a matter of opinion. It's not as though if I thought otherwise, rape would be okay, or if everybody thought otherwise, rape would be okay. Rape is wrong, full stop. So at least if you're worried about whether there could be genuine morality where there are facts of the matter, then on an atheist account, I'm inclined to think, well, of course there can. We might wonder, what makes it wrong? And the answer is, well, it's wrong because, for example, rape is wrong because it harms the victim. You might ask instead, what do we mean in saying that it's wrong to rape? Now, this is a controversial matter. Not all moral philosophers agree about the ingredients that we need to build into the basic definition of right and wrong. But roughly, I take it that as at least a first pass, the thought is something like to believe in morality is a genuine, objective state of affairs is to believe that there are reasons to act morally, to help others and to avoid harming them. and that these reasons don't depend on the particular desires or goals you happen to have. It's not as though if you happen to care about truth, justice, and the American way, then you've got a reason to act morally. No, everybody has these reasons. These reasons are overriding, to use philosophers' jargon, they're categorical reasons. So when I say that it's an objective fact that rape is wrong, what I'm saying is there's this kind of overriding, strong, categorical reason not to harm people in this way. And that's not up to me to make it so, it's just so. Now, we might ask, is there a deeper account that can be offered about where these reasons come from, or what makes them so, or what are the basic rules of morality, what their ultimate foundation or basis is? And I want to say that secular atheist philosophers disagree about that point. Some are, as we might call them, non-foundationalists. They say, well, we can state the various moral rules, keep your promises, tell the truth, don't tell lies, don't hurt people, help the needy. And if we want, we can boil these rules down into a simpler set of rules. I've suggested don't harm, do help. But there may be nothing at all deeper to be said about what makes those rules the rule, what makes those rules the valid rules. It's just an objective fact about reality that there are these categorical reasons. There are reasons to behave in certain ways versus other. So that's not just a matter of opinion. There are facts about what there are reasons to do. And these may be among the reasons that there's nothing deeper to say. But there are also philosophers who believe there is something more to say. And again, unsurprisingly, different philosophers will disagree about what that deeper story looks like. Let me give a very quick sketch of one such story. I think it's not bad as far as it goes. Ultimately, I think there's even more to say, but that would take us a rather long time to say that more. So let me just give you the quick sketch. It's a version of the view that's known as contractarianism. The thought is that the moral rules are the rules that we would give to one another to govern our interactions with one another, the rules that we would agree to if we were to set about trying to settle on a bunch of rules to govern our interactions under the assumption that we were perfectly rational. Nobody wants to follow rules that people accept because of mistakes in their reasoning. So imagine us, but soup ourselves up to be reasoning perfectly, perfectly rational beings, would agree to various rules to govern their interactions. And the rules that they agree to are the terms of morality. Now, there's different ways of running this contractarian thought. One version of it, which I have some sympathies to, adds an extra twist. The reasoning needs to take place behind a so-called veil of ignorance. The thought is, I'm not going to know while I'm engaged in this hypothetical bargaining session what my actual position in society is. I won't be able to try to rig things in favor of white males because I won't know that I'm a white male. So I argue from behind this veil of ignorance about my actual identity. So that's the basic thought. So here we have a kind of deeper story. Where do the moral rules come from? They are the rules we give to ourselves to govern our behavior with one another insofar as we were perfectly rational. Does this capture a notion of objectivity for ethics? Seems to me the answer is yes. There's a fact of the matter about what it would be rational for us to agree to in terms of these rules. One might wonder, is the output of this hypothetical, imaginary bargaining session, are the moral rules necessary? Maybe that's another feature we're looking for in trying to genuinely get morality as opposed to merely the illusion or appearance of morality. And the answer to that is, yes, I believe they are necessary. Now, if you're a non-foundationalist, if you don't think there is a deeper story of the contractarian sort that I sketched, or some other deeper story that other moral philosophers have sketched, if you're a non-foundationalist, you might just stop it right here. You might say, to say that murder is wrong is to say that there's a categorical reason not to murder. And this isn't a contingent truth, it's a necessary truth. It's a truth that obtains, as philosophers like to put it, in all possible worlds, that murder would be wrong. If we do go the contractarian route, then we instead might put our necessity a little bit deeper. We might say something like, the moral truths are necessary, but their truth is itself explained in terms of a social contract, and that in turn is explained in terms of the fact that there are certain truths about reasoning And these are necessary truths. It's a necessary fact that perfectly rational beings would reason about what kinds of rules they wanted to give to one another in such and such a way. So I think we can get the necessity of morality as well. Here's a rather different objection that might get raised. We have the thought that morality involves commandments. We have the thought that morality involves requirements. We talk about moral laws. So sometimes it's suggested that where there's a commandment, there's got to be a commander. Where there's a law, there's got to be a lawgiver. Where there's a requirement, there's got to be a requirer. Who plays the role of commander, lawgiver, requirer? Well, it's got to be God. And so it turns out if we're really going to have the notion not just of moral reason to behave in this way or that way, but rather moral requirements to behave in one way rather than another way, then we need to appeal to God after all, to be the lawgiver. This is an argument that's been proposed by various theistic philosophers. Indeed, this argument's been embraced by some atheistic philosophers who said, talk of moral requirements does presuppose a lawgiver. Now that I no longer believe in God, I believe there are no moral requirements. Now, I'm not myself inclined to go that way. I'm perfectly prepared to talk about moral requirements. I think it's a completely appropriate thing to do. In fact, it would be inappropriate, it would be just simply mistaken, full stop, to give up talk about moral requirements. So the question I want to push a little bit is it really true that requirements require a requirer? That's a mouthful. And I'm inclined to believe the answer to that is actually no. Let's take an example of a requirement outside the moral domain. I suppose that when we are engaged in reasoning about belief matters, theoretical reasoning, it's a requirement of appropriate reasoning that you not contradict yourself. People sometimes talk about the law of non-contradiction. I take this to be a requirement of rationality, that you not contradict yourself. Now, should we similarly conclude that since there's a requirement, there's a law of non-contradiction, there must be a lawgiver, there must be some cosmic logician who commands us not to contradict ourselves? Doesn't seem to me to be so. I mean, I can imagine that somebody does say that, but I don't myself feel the force of thinking if there's a law of non-contradiction, that is just to say it's a claim that it's just fundamentally irrational to contradict yourself, I don't see any reason to conclude from that there must be some cosmic logician laying down that law. As Mike put it, the logic of the word requirement does not actually entail the existence of a requirer. That at least seems to me the most natural thing to say about the law of non-contradiction. If we want, we can say, and I don't think any harm in saying, that reason itself requires that you not contradict yourself. And that's fine. I don't have any problem talking that way. That just, of course, doesn't... I mean, it's talking about reason in a somewhat personified fashion, but no harm done as long as we understand there doesn't actually have to be a person who laid down the law of non-contradiction. Well, similarly, then, I want to say that with regard to the various moral requirements, we don't need a lawgiver for them to be genuine requirements. If we want, we can say, in fact, it seems to be a perfectly legitimate thing to say, that reason requires that we act in accordance with reasons. It lays down these various categorical reasons not to harm people, to aid them. And so we can personify reason in that way, but all we just mean, I think, is that there are these compelling, decisive, objective, categorical reasons to behave in certain ways and not behave in other ways, or to reason in various ways. So I myself am skeptical of the claim that commandments require a commander, or requirements require a requirer, or that law requires a lawgiver. So some of you may be more sympathetic to that suggestion than I am. Indeed, some of my colleagues are more sympathetic to that suggestion than I am. It's important to bear in mind that although I have the particular views I'm laying down here, it's not as though all non-theistic philosophers think about these issues in exactly the same way. If you brought up four of us, you'd probably get four different stories about how to ground morality in a secular fashion. Some of my colleagues are more sympathetic to the thought that moral talk of moral requirement really does entail that there be somebody who's commanding us to behave accordingly. And then we might ask, well, if that's so, who could it be besides God? And the answer I want to give on behalf of those of you and my colleagues who are sympathetic to the suggestion, the answer should be all of us. We, the members of the moral community, are the ones who are laying down these requirements. That idea is especially, I think, a natural fit if we accept the contractarian theory that I was sketching, albeit too quickly, sketching in my earlier remarks. If we think of the rules of morality as emerging from this hypothetical session in which we ask ourselves, how shall we behave towards one another? Except we face this question hypothetically in the mode of perfect rationality. What would perfectly rational beings lay down as these rules? But these are rules that nonetheless we are giving to one another. Then when somebody, and we enter into these rules freely, because we see that it makes sense for us to reach these agreements, you can see why it would be rational for us to agree to rules requiring telling the truth, laying out, forbidding lying, forbidding murder, and so forth. Then these are rules that we give to one another. And consequently, if somebody breaks those rules, they're not upholding their part of the social contract. And as such, the rest of us who are indeed limiting our behavior in keeping with this agreement, we can appropriately and with due authority turn to the person who's acting immorally and saying, you shouldn't behave that way. You're not keeping up your end of the bargain. So if you think there needs to be somebody who's demanding of us that we act morally, the answer could be, well, there is. Each one of us is demanding of everybody else, and indeed demanding of ourselves as well, that we act morally. So if you think requirements need a requirer, the answer could be, well, here's a requirer. It's the members of the moral community. Well, obviously, there's a great deal more that needs to be said about all these subjects, but I've used up my allotted 20 minutes. But I hope you can at least see the outlines of an approach, there are alternatives, an approach which offers us a fairly plausible, I think, account of what morality is all about, under which the rules of morality are not an illusion, they're not a mere matter of opinion, they are indeed a matter of objective fact. And consequently, I'm inclined to think that moral philosophers of an atheistic inclination are completely entitled to believe that we can have morality without God. Thank you.
All right. Grab the lights from
me. Yeah, grab those lights. Remember how? Grab
them. So, what'd y'all think?
I sound argument. It was interesting, yeah.
So, like, very above
our
head.
Well,
you
were sleeping.
What was interesting to me is that his entire argument
stop turning around
seemed to be based on an assumption that everybody has some innate value worth respecting with positive morality, yet he never touched on why or how we gained that value, who gave it to
Ooh,
us.
Nice. Yeah, there's a underlying assumption of value
right.
to life. So underlying assumption that actually what is a very clear recognition of actual human nature to a point. Up to the point where he doesn't actually come out and say, I think he does later, that we can never live up to this standard, but that we can conceive of this standard. And he seems to recognize the morality that does actually exist. The sketch that he made is pretty darn close to the real one that God is and created in this world. That don't harm, do help is a fairly accurate representation of morality. And as you listen to him, I've listened to more of his lectures and arguments, he he understands morality as it truly is. He just doesn't understand the source of it. And that's where I wanted to... So, where does he argue that morality as an... He affirms that it is an objective fact, that it is... The two examples that come up a lot further in the debate is rape and the Nazis. That even if the Nazis had won and had succeeded in brainwashing everyone to believe that it was right to kill Jews, it would still actually, truly, in reality, be wrong. Even if everyone on earth believed it, doesn't make it so, it's still wrong. That's the position that he holds. And he says, so how does he ground that? How does he say, we can say that objective morality, right and wrong, does exist? What was his argument of how that gets grounded? And it's on the back in the middle, if you... We're following along. It's under foundationalists.
Oh, that the rules or that the requirements are made up by the moral community? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. And that's a step further than he would put it. What were you going to say?
It seems like he was slightly self-contradictory there if he was saying, you know, if the Nazis had brainwashed everybody and we all believed it was rational to kill Jews, it would still be wrong.
He would say if we all believed it was right to kill Jews.
But based on his concept of morality, everybody being in agreement with what's moral, then he's contradicting himself.
See, and that's what I'm saying. It's one step too far to say that he's saying what everybody agrees is wrong. He's creating this hypothetical situation. What is the hypothetical situation that he's putting
forward?
That
everyone will agree on one thing.
That everyone agrees, and what's the basis of that agreement that he...
That it is, like, well, what do you mean?
Read the... So, one foundationalist account. The next point. The moral rules are the ones we would agree to if... What's the if?
We're perfectly rational.
So he would go forward and say, but not every society is perfectly rational, not all humans are perfectly rational, which is why we don't have perfect assent to morality at this point, and why if one society all agreed, they had a flaw in their rationality. They've had a flaw in their reasoning when coming up with their moral thing. So the idea of this objective thing is this hypothetical situation grounded purely in reason and rationality for him. You see how he sneaks around that, essentially. The big fallacy that he commits. So, essentially, if you were to boil down, how does he answer the question, where does morality come from? He would say it comes from reason. It comes from rationality.
So, basically, the people can make their own moral law.
Yes.
By their own rationality.
Yeah, well, and he argues that rationality exists outside of humans. So the example that he gave was how do we even then people are required for, but he's saying no, there's laws of logic that exist outside of anyone saying that they exist. They just exist. The law of non-contradiction, it just is so. And if you're going to reason rationally, then you have to abide by those laws. And there's that moral requirement to follow those laws. Otherwise, you don't have reason and rationality. So his argument is consistent in that respect, that if rationality were a self-existent thing that simply was, it would follow. And which is where Craig doesn't pick up on that particular thing and needs to press home that hypothetical situation, one, doesn't exist, and two... You then are just pushing the question one further back of not where does morality come from, but where does reason come from? Where does rationality come from? So he's essentially just offsetting the question. Where does morality come from? It comes from reason. Okay, well, where does reason come from? Well, it comes from God. God created the reality, the reason, the rationality that we have. And so it is only because of some... And so he painted that picture in a little bit of a sarcastic tone of there doesn't have to be this cosmic logician saying that it is so, it's just so. And Christians would actually have to argue, no, there is a cosmic logician that says it's so, and that's why it is so. And to say that it's not is to say that things can exist without something causing it to exist.
Isn't there there something called an irreducible something or other, an argument? What is that?
I think you're thinking of irreducible complexity. The argument of first cause, and he alluded to this too, the idea of categorical reasons. Mm-hmm. So he said there eventually we just got to a point where we can't keep arguing about where does it come from and how far back do we push it. We can't ask why is it so. We just have to accept that it is so.
Yeah.
And that's where and if we watch part of the back and forth, which I hope we'll get to, you'll hear that part. But that's where his argument comes from. His argument is rationality produces morality. And so if we were all perfectly rational, then we could enter into this bargaining session and come up with the laws of morality, and those are the laws that exist in objective reality. The sense of the fallacy, one, is reframing the issue. He doesn't actually say, where does rationality then come from? He doesn't give a source for it, or at least he doesn't give a source for rationality. He gives a source that is yet another created thing that needs another source.
It's almost like he's treating rationality, he's personifying it.
And there's the fallacy. So that he talks, so that's when he presents that, he talks about, I'm comfortable talking about, as if we say reason itself dictates, and we can personify it in that way. He actually says those exact words. We can personify it in that way as long as we recognize that we're not saying that there's some kind of actual will behind it, that's just the way that it is. And there's the fallacy, because to talk about it as if it is personified and say that there is moral requirement from it is to give it a will, in which case it's lining up almost identically with the definition of God. God defines rationality and reason. So it's really, like I said, sneaky. The other really sneaky one, which I think I made sure I wrote down the quotes in here. At the very end of the front page, he's coming through the objections to his model of morality. And so one of the questions he poses, the hypothetical objection, he says, what makes it wrong? And I would say, well, it's wrong because it harms the victim. That's circular reasoning.
Yeah, it went back to what... Yeah,
exactly.
That's
straight up circular reasoning. What makes something wrong? Well, it's wrong because it harms. Well, what makes harming something, or why shouldn't we harm something? Because it's wrong. You're saying things that are true, but you're not going any further.
Yeah, you're just going back and forth and back and forth.
Exactly. It's simple circular reasoning. But when he presents it, it's just, oh yeah, of course, that'd be what makes it wrong. Because the moral law that he presented is don't harm, do help. Okay, but what makes that the moral law? And that's what he goes on further and says, reason is what makes that the moral law. But he hangs out for a while on that, and he tries throughout the whole debate to put the focus on, look, this is the moral law, and I'm saying it without an appeal to God, so God isn't necessary for it. Recognizing that something exists is not the same thing as saying where that thing that exists came from. And that's the fallacy that Craig doesn't pick up on. So I hope this is one of my favorite debates, because he's very good at what he does. And he's a very likable and humble guy. And that's, again, part of why I think he loses, in my mind, is there's parts in the back and forth where he just clearly has the moral high ground, almost, or at least the logical high ground, where he's more consistent within his view than Craig is when he presents it in the way he's talking about it. And he's very humble about it. He's very congenial and likable as he's talking. And so it.
So why would he lose it in that case? Why would he lose the debate if he's likable?
No, Kagan won. Kagan is very likable, and the guy who was just talking, the atheist, he's a very nice guy, and I think he's very logically consistent to a point. He hasn't dealt honestly with reason itself.
He draws lines in his arguments that he won't cross.
Exactly. So Craig presents what is really his standard opening statements with a few embellishments, and I'll let you guys watch that. He's a masterful presenter. He's very clear. He does this thing where he counts to keep you engaged and focused. First point, second point there. Great presenter. But I think it's more profitable to watch the back and forth part of the debate, because you don't have a real debate until there's interaction. And so he presents an argument that is essentially the one that I think we all hold to, that God is, there must be some first cause of morality. And the objection that Kagan sketched, the idea of a moral law, there must be a moral law giver, that's Craig's position. That's the argument he essentially makes. That since there's a moral law, there must be a moral law giver, to boil it down to one phrase. But yeah, and if Kagan's went over your head, Craig's will go even further over your head. Which is why we're skipping it, because yet another thing of reason, little things that contribute to why I think he lost the debate, was that he wasn't personable. He didn't relate on a understandable level as much, which normally he doesn't have any problem with. So I've wondered why he did this. Yeah. Now we'll watch the cross-examination.
These questions must, I think, be addressed if one is to maintain that God is not necessary to morality.
We'll now have 10 minutes of questioning between Dr. Craig asking Dr. Kagan about his thoughts.
Well, obviously, a number of questions came up in my talk that would be pertinent to what you shared, Shelley. In your opening address, you said right or wrong depends upon the whether you hurt other people without justification. And when asked, are these really wrong, you answered yes. Why? Because it harms the victim. Now, I guess my difficulty is that I certainly agree that it's wrong to harm people, obviously, but it's hard for me to understand, on a naturalistic worldview, such as I described, why on the worldview of naturalism, inflicting harm upon other members of our species is really wrong. It seems to me that this happens all the time among other animals. And so why is it wrong peculiarly for human beings to inflict harm on each other?
All right, so let's start with that. So suppose that my 3-year-old nephew walks into your house, takes some book off your shelf, and tears the pages out. He hasn't done anything wrong. Or 3-year-old, probably old enough, he has done anything wrong. Maybe a year and a half, he hasn't done anything wrong. If I go into your house, tear some pages out of your book, I've done something wrong. What's the difference? Well, I'm capable of appreciating reasons for respecting your property that my 1.5-year-old, this is hypothetical, 1.5-year-old nephew, doesn't have the capacity, right? There are differences between people that allow me and you to think about our behaviors, to evaluate our behaviors, to see whether or not there are legitimate reasons for behaving as we do. Creatures that don't have that capacity don't have that capacity. It's precisely because they lack that capacity that makes no sense that the notion of right and wrong behavior gets no purchase. Lions can't reflect upon their behavior, so when they do it, it's not wrong. If you or I were engaged in that behavior, we can reflect upon that. We can recognize the reasons we're not behaving that way. So I think the distinction is a fairly straightforward one, not a deep mystery or a hard challenge for the naturalist to respond to.
Okay. I'm going to do this as we go through the crossfire. Where's the error in Kagan's answer? Or was there one? Put it that way.
That his 1.5-year-old nephew didn't do anything wrong.
Boom. Why?
Because it was still wrong.
It's still wrong.
It's still harm. It's still harms, but he's not accountable. There's no accountability for him.
It's still wrong. It's just easier to forgive.
Right.
It's more understandable. So he's still committed a moral wrong. It's just that we, in our grace, or in our forgiveness, or as he said, in our reason, can look for more reasons to forgive that wrong. So yeah, that would be the error that Craig should
jump
Does that pertain to adults who are mentally ill also?
Yeah.
Is that why?
And that's where I would go with it.
System for them, in not punishing them, but helping them if there's a crime commit and they're proven mentally ill.
That's where I would go for it. There are things that my brother has to do, whether he understands it or not.
Right.
He's wrong for doing certain things, and he doesn't understand it, but he still has to do them. He doesn't have the rationality that Kagan's describing, but he's still committing moral wrongs, and he still is held accountable to them by us, his family. So his answer doesn't hold water in that regard.
I think that's a good answer for why we wouldn't regard animals as moral agents who would be culpable for their acts. But it seems to me that at best that answer would go to show that rationality or the ability to reflect rationally on things is a necessary condition for moral behavior. But I don't see that that's a sufficient condition for moral behavior. It's still not clear to me why it would be wrong for creatures who have considerably complex neurological systems to inflict harm on each other on a naturalistic worldview in the struggle for survival.
Okay, so the question you asked initially was, how can I explain why it's wrong for me to murder when it's not wrong for lions to murder? And to answer that question, all it takes is for me to point out a relevant difference between us. And you've just, I think, said, yeah, all right, so I managed to do that. If we now shift to the question, so what does it take for wrongness to enter the world above and beyond rationality? I think the answer might well be, actually, once we achieve a certain level of rationality, nothing more is taken. Nothing more is needed. The reason it's objectively wrong for me to engage in murder is precisely because there is a reason for me not to do it. A reason that I'm capable of recognizing. And if you ask, what more does it take? The answer is, well, those are the basic ingredients right there. We can refine it. I mean, we can put a little icing on it if we'd like to make it. But in terms of the essentials, that's it. What there's reason for me to do depends on what kind of creature I am. Once I become the kind of creature in the evolutionary, process, once creatures evolve that are capable of stepping back from their actions, capable of reflecting about whether or not their behavior makes sense, whether it conforms to standards that they are themselves prepared to endorse, at that point, the machinery is in place. And at that point, there are reasons for me to behave in certain ways and to avoid other kinds of behavior. And if you ask, but what makes that wrong?
Why these beings suddenly achieve moral, intrinsic moral worth in virtue of having these complex nervous systems that enables them to have self-reflection and so forth.
If you put it as complex nervous systems, it sounds pretty deflationary.
Right.
What's so special about having a complex nervous system? But of course, that complex nervous system allows you to do calculus. It allows you to do astrophysics. It allows you to write poetry. It allows you to fall in love. Put under that description, you ask, what's so special about humans from a naturalist perspective? I'm at a loss to know how to answer that question. If you don't see why we'd be special and different from everything else in creation, that because we can do poetry, we can write a novel, we can think philosophical thoughts, we can do calculus, and we can think about the morality of our behavior, I don't know what kind of answer could possibly satisfy you at that point.
Well, obviously, the kind of answer that I offered, but
we'll pause it there.
Funny you said, Shelley Kagan said everything else in creation.
Yeah. I thought that was, why did he say creation if he didn't? Yeah.
He borrows language a lot from the Christian worldview.
Probably because he hasn't really come to firm conclusions.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
There's two fallacies, or one is just bad logic, the other one is an actual argumentation fallacy. The first one is, he basically implied that morality doesn't enter the picture until evolution reaches a certain point.
Right.
Did you catch that? So it wasn't until people evolved to a point where they could understand...
Well,
that morality actually exists. And he was arguing earlier that morality is an objective thing that is true in all worlds, at all places. So there's a slight logical error that he would have to address. Of, are you saying that it only enters the picture when evolution reaches a certain point? Was it there before evolution reached that certain point, or was it not? And in that case, what made it a reality then, if reason, human reason, hadn't come along yet? So that would be something that, again, Craig should have pressed him on. The other thing was reframing the issue when when Craig does this little slight, basically saying, you know, what makes it so great about complex nervous systems that makes morality enter the picture? And he stops him and says, well, when you say it like that, it sounds very deflationary, but that thing allows us to do all of these great things, love, calculus, etc., write poetry. And if you put it that way, what I'm at a loss as to how to answer that. What makes it so great? Obviously, it's so great. He didn't answer the question. That's reframing the issue, saying it a different way, so that essentially saying, well, I don't have to answer that.
A nice dodge.
Yeah. And he's about to press the dodge, which is when kick, kick, kick. So that's what he's about to do.
To follow up on that, because I'm tempted to say I can play this game, and that's unfair, because, of course, it's not a game. But I can pose the same kinds of questions to you. Perhaps I will. You know, I'm not going to intend that. I can say, well, all right, so God says, you know, you guys are really, really special.
Right.
What did that? How does his saying it make us really special? But you see, he gave us a soul. How does our having a soul make us special? Whatever answer you give, you could always say, with regard to that, what's so special about that? At a certain point, you're just going to have to say, you know what? These features really do seem to me to be special. Insofar as it seems to me that our ability to communicate, to reflect, to love, to be creative, and consequently to shape our behavior with an eye towards how we're interacting with one another, these things strike me as remarkable ways in which we're special.
I think that...
All right. What does the Christian say to that?
Say to what?
That statement that at a certain point you have to stop and say, these features make it obvious that this thing is special. And in the example he gave, well, what makes humans... God says that humans are special. What makes them special? Well, he gave us a soul. How does having a soul be special? What are you thinking about those things? What do you notice?
You know, basically just watching the debate, I don't know why he's reacting in such an emotional way that is ungrounded to me. And why is he... Is that, to me, like, he's not coming to conclusions himself. He's continually asking questions on this. He may have a belief system, but I don't think he's grounded in it. This is what I'm picking up. I can't see him really being grounded in what he believes.
The most basic... I don't know if this is the most basic answer to your question, but we were creating God's image.
There you go. That's what I was going for.
That, that's what differentiates us from all of other creation.
Uh-huh.
We were created in His image, very explicit in that.
Yeah, so that's the second part of he gives a bad answer to the question of, well, what makes... God says that humans are special. What makes it special? Well, wait a second. That's not why humans are special. Humans are special because they're created in the image of God, and God is the source of all things that are special. So for the Christian, it always comes back to God as an existent being. That is where we draw all of our things. So, again, he sets up this false pattern and then presses it and says, at a certain point, we have to just say, these features reflect to me that something is special. So what I was saying was Kagan is essentially doing a post-production view of worth. He's saying, once something is created, once something is, and we look at it, and again, reason enters into it, says, once we see that these things are worthwhile, we simply have to sit back and say, these things do merit worth. Whereas the Christian would say, that's an after-the-fact thing. Worth has to be given beforehand. Just recognizing that they have worth isn't saying where the worth came from. The features together, there's so many that work together. That's what gives it worth. Well, all of those individual features, what's their source? And he doesn't answer that question. Again, a nice little dodge.
He's a lot. It's something that we step into.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's the argument about the morality that we, you know, going back to the evolutionary argument, it's we get to a point where we could discover and understand,
mm-hmm.
and which lends itself to something that existed before, that it was there to be discovered.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it's there to be discovered, then the question is, who, you know, it's got to be who put it there.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm probably repeating what we've talked about already, but that's where you would have to, I don't know where this guy goes.
That's good. Yeah, well, and that's a good way to boil it down. As Christians say, we come along and we notice something that has been discovered. We discover it and we say, how did it get there? And Kagan does a great way of reframing it always to simply say, well, once it's discovered, that it answers the question, and it doesn't. But he always says it in such a way that you almost believe him while he's talking. It's really fun to listen to his lectures at Yale, actually. You can watch a lot on YouTube.
I feel like all of Kagan's answers and responses, they stop at a certain point. Like,
yeah.
he'll use the words value, rationality, but I don't think he could give an adequate description or...
No. And that answer they just gave, yeah. At a certain point, we just have to say, these things do seem to have worth to
it.
Yeah.
Really
we got 15 minutes left. I want you to hear that again, because that little sneaky thing that he did right there was to say, at a certain point, we have to just say, these things do have value. Where the Christian says, no. The only stopping point is when you get back to God and his nature and his existence. That's the only place you can stop. And until you get there, you haven't gone far enough back. There's still more questions to ask. And Craig doesn't push him on it. But so hear that again. And that's where it kind of breaks down. Is everything comes back to, well, we got to stop. We got to draw a line that we're not going to cross.
In your book, I've done something wrong. What's the difference? Well, I'm capable of appreciating reasons for respecting your property that my 1.5-year-old, this is hypothetical, 1.5-year-old nephew, doesn't have the capacity, right? There are differences between people that allow me and you to think about our behaviors, to evaluate our behaviors, to see whether or not there are legitimate reasons for behaving as we do. Creatures that don't have that capacity don't have that capacity. It's precisely because they lack that capacity that makes no sense that the notion of right or wrong behavior gets no purchase. Lions can't reflect upon their behavior, so when they do it, it's not wrong. If you or I were engaged in that behavior, we can reflect upon that. We can recognize the reasons for not behaving that way. So I think the distinction is a fairly straightforward one, not a deep mystery or a hard challenge for the naturalist to respond to.
Okay, I think that's a good answer for why we wouldn't regard animals as moral agents who would be culpable for their acts. But it seems to me that at best that answer would go to show that rationality or the ability to reflect rationally on things is a necessary condition for moral behavior. But I don't see that that's a sufficient condition for moral behavior. It's still not clear to me why it would be wrong for creatures who have considerably complex neurological systems to inflict harm on each other on a naturalistic worldview in the struggle for survival.
Okay, so the question you asked initially was, how can I explain why it's wrong for me to murder?
And this is really good argumentation by Shelley, actually, when he says, well, let me just show you that I did answer your question. Really masterfully done at that point.
When it's not wrong for lions to murder. And to answer that question, all it takes is for me to point out a relevant difference between us. And you just, I think, said, yeah, all right, so I managed to do that. If we now shift to the question, so what does it take for wrongness to enter the world above and beyond rationality? I think the answer might well be, actually, once we achieve a certain level of rationality, nothing more is taken. Nothing more is needed. The reason it's objectively wrong for me to engage in murder is precisely because there is a reason for me not to do it. A reason that I'm capable of recognizing. And if you ask, what more does it take? The answer is, well, that those are the basic ingredients right there. We can refine it. I mean, we can put a little icing on it if we'd like to make it. But in terms of the essentials, that's it. What there's reason for me to do depends on what kind of creature I am. Once I become the kind of creature in the evolutionary, you know, process, once creatures evolve that are capable of stepping back from their actions, capable of reflecting about whether or not their behavior makes sense, whether it conforms to standards that they are themselves prepared to endorse, at that point the machinery is in place. And at that point, there are reasons for me to behave in certain ways and to avoid other kinds of behavior. And if you ask, but what makes that wrong? You know,
I'm still not clear as to why these beings suddenly achieve moral, intrinsic moral worth in virtue of having these complex nervous systems that enables them to have self-reflection and so forth.
If you put it as complex nervous systems, it sounds pretty deflationary.
Right.
What's so special about having a complex nervous system? But of course, that complex nervous system allows you to do calculus. It allows you to do astrophysics. It allows you to write poetry. It allows you to fall in love. Put under that description, you ask, what's so special about humans from a naturalist perspective? I'm at a loss to know how to answer that question. If you don't see why we'd be special and different from everything else in creation, that because we can do poetry, we can write a novel, we can think philosophical thoughts, we can do calculus, and we can think about the morality of our behavior, I don't know what kind of answer could possibly satisfy you at that point.
Well, obviously, the kind of answer that I offered, but
can I ask just to follow up on that? Because I'm tempted to say I can play this game, and that's unfair, because of course it's not a game, but I could pose the same kinds of questions to you. Perhaps I will, you know, I'm not going to intend to. I could say, look, all right, so God says, you know, you guys are really, really special.
Right.
What did that? How does his saying it make us really special? But you see, he gave us a soul. How does our having a soul make us special? Whatever answer you give, you could always say, with regard to that, what's so special about that? At a certain point, you're just going to have to say, you know what? These features really do seem to me to be special. Insofar as it seems to me that our ability to communicate, to reflect, to love, to be creative, and consequently to shape our behavior with an eye towards how we're interacting with one another, these things strike me as remarkable ways in which we're special.
I think that they strike all of us that way. That's the difficulty, perhaps, I think, showing what I'm attempting to show, is that we all do, I think, intuitively value one another. We value persons. We value poetry, creativity, and all of these things. I think we all agree that these are goods. The question is, though, on a naturalistic view, why think that these things are goods? It seems to me that you emphasize in your own book, On the Limits of Morality, the importance of having explanations and not cutting off the search for explanations too soon. And I wonder if you're not cutting off the search for explanations too soon by simply saying, well, I'm just going to regard persons as intrinsically valuable, but without any kind of further grounding for that.
But, of course, I haven't claimed there is no further grounding for that. I gave you a sketch of the contractarian thought. Your attitude was, I don't find that a very compelling story. It doesn't seem to me to be the kind of thing that constitutes an adequate grounding. I suppose these things are in the eyes of the beholder, and everybody here is entitled to decide for themselves what kind of answers will be satisfactory or not.
Let me ask you a different question.
Yeah, one more.
Oh, okay. Are you a determinist?
Yes.
And yet you still think that love is significant and human choices are really significant, even though they're determined?
So to give a piece of jargon to the audience that Bill will be familiar with, I'm a compatibilist. That is to say, I believe that one can combine determinism and free will. So absent free will, humans would lack the significance that we clearly have. But I believe that's compatible with determinism. Actually, am I a determinist? who knows what quantum mechanics teaches us about whether or not determinism is true, but at least I believe that determinism could be true without in any way threatening my conviction that humans are special.
Did you have a follow-up on that one?
Well,
to explain real quick, determinism is the belief that because the evolutionary worldview, that everything boils down to chemicals and reactions and et cetera, there's no guiding force outside of the physical world. All things are then determined by those chemical reactions. There's no way you could ever have a thought that wasn't determined by the chemical reactions in your body producing that thought at that time.
So that would be the reason.
Yeah. So the concepts of things like love and free will are
chemically driven.
They're not really you. There's no will inside of you. It's just biology. It's just one chemical reacting with another, causing some reaction that leads to the thing that you do.
Basis for morality. Yeah.
Yeah. Correct. I don't think that explains.
Then reasoning. Really. Then there would be really no such thing as reasoning.
Right.
Yeah, I would agree.
Based on that.
Well, and that's.
It seems like he doesn't come to conclusions.
Yeah, and that's part of that is that he's just on such a different hemisphere than the rest of us in terms of how he thinks and what he's read. So he's trying to boil down crazy complex thoughts to understandable levels without knowing the terminology. But the other part of that is that you're right, that in fact he does not have a ground to stand on. No atheist truly does. He knows the truth and is suppressing it in his heart in unrighteousness, as Romans says. To give you one more piece of jargon, there's two kinds of Christian apologetics, or there's a lot of kinds, but two main ones. The synthetic approach, which is what William Lane Craig is, which is to say we can use argumentation sans the Bible. Theoretically, you could argue and create rational arguments that would point to the truth of Christianity without necessarily appealing to the Bible for your foundation. You can use those as supporting arguments, but that can't be what you're built on. Presuppositionalist apologetics would say, no, I'm coming at this being totally frank that the Bible is what I claim is the foundation of my arguments and God's nature. And so I'm not trying to argue in a secular sort of way to get you to recognize a Christian idea, which is what Craig would do. The synthetic one would say, like, we could argue about whether or not God exists without pointing to scriptures as compelling reasons why God exists. Whereas the presuppositionalist says, I'm coming from my worldview, no holds barred. And I actually think presuppositional apologetics is the better way of doing this, the more consistent way of doing apologetics. You get into these issues that you really can't answer without appealing to biblical texts. So
it's hard to explain truth or rationality without mentioning the source.
Yeah, exactly. You're cutting yourself off at the knees, I think, if you're a synthetic apologist. But
I think it's showing in their behavior, too. As you watch the film, one is very calm, one seems very anxious to get his point across.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Kagan is obviously, you know, highly intelligent, very smart, and he's good at arguing the points that he can make, but I feel like he knows the answers he doesn't have.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll run circles.
And he's good at dodging
what he can explain.
Yeah. Just redirect it to something he's already said. Yeah.
You can tell he's dodging, by the way, again, by the physical body language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's very closed.
Mm-hmm. Kagan?
Leaning back, legs crossed.
Yeah.
Crazed.
Oh, see, and
leaning forward.
I was thinking the exact opposite. I think Kagan looks really relaxed and comfortable, and Craig looks uncomfortable. But
yeah.
Only to say that it just seems to me to rob moral choices of any sort of significance if we're determined to do it by the antecedent physical causes that lead up to the point of choosing, and then cause our brains to react one way rather than another. I can't see how
that could have any more moral significance than a tree growing a branch at a certain point in its development.
Because you're a non-incompatibilist. You don't believe determinism and free will. So this is a debate for another night. I mean, it's not that I think the truth of compatibilism is at all self-evident.
Can you just explain what that term means?
Compatibilism is the view that there's no logical inconsistency between belief in determinism on the one hand and the existence of free will on the other. They're compatible.
Well, it's a little bit misleading, though. I mean, you need to explain what you mean by free will in that case, if everything's determined.
What I was trying to do is simply give a quick definition. I said that this is a very, as you know, it's a very, very complicated question. We will basically hijack the entire rest of the evening to start trying to...
I'm unclear on the terms myself.
So my thought was just that the plausibility of the compatibilist view that I hold, I don't take to be self-evident. I believe it takes philosophical argumentation for it. I completely agree that those drawn to incompatibilism, those drawn to the view that you can't have both deterministic physical laws and robust free will think if naturalism is true, and the best science teaches us that determinism is true, itself a controversial question whether that's the best interpretation of our best science, then we'll lack free will. And then if free will is necessary for having special value, then we'll lack special value. But there's a lot of premises before we get to the conclusion that naturalism doesn't have space for this special value, and I reject several of those premises, which is why I'm not feeling uncomfortable by the challenge that Bill's raising.
Well, let's turn the table, and now you'll ask Bill some questions.
All right. So one of the things that you said in your opening remarks, you quoted several people, I think there was a long quote from Michael Ruse, saying something like...
pretty much time to go, but... and also lots of his questions won't make sense since you didn't hear Craig's opening remark. I'd highly encourage you to go watch the whole debate online, and watch some other, particularly the William Lane Craig Christopher Hitchens debate is a great one to watch. Christopher Hitchens was kind of tipsy that night, and you can tell. It's a funny debate. Christopher Hitchens was one of the leading guys of the new atheist movement that got resurgence about, I guess, about 15 years ago now. Richard Dawkins, you might know that name, wrote The God Delusion. Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris are kind of the big names in that movement, and so, but William Lane Craig's debate with Christopher Hitchens is really funny. He just destroys him.
Can you email us that link on YouTube?
Yeah, I can find it and email it for you.
Kagan gives a lot of solid reasons for morality, but he doesn't know how to give an answer to why.
Yeah. Didn't give a reason for reason.
Yeah.
Oh. So next week we're going to be talking about abortion, contraception, in vitro fertilization. So.